Thank you all so much for allowing me to be before you this morning. We're going to be talking about kind of something I've observed the last little bit in both my studies and kind of the world around me. This was a couple weeks ago. You guys might be familiar with Savannah Guthrie. She's kind of the news anchor, used to be the news anchor on the Today Show. And without getting into too much of what's going on in her life, she's just gone through a big stretch of time with her mom and a lot of questions going on with that. And so it was a few weeks ago, the day before Easter, the Saturday before Easter, she released a video in which she just kind of confronted some challenges she's faced in her life. Savannah is going to kind of, for our sake this morning, represent like a modern prolific figure who advocates for Christ and lives out Christ in her life. But, you know, just saying like she's some popular culture icon is like underselling. She's, you know, a lawyer who became really popular on the Today Show and so became a big anchor on there. So a very intelligent woman, successful woman, but she was observing in her own life and she confronted and confided something that kind of got viral and almost, I would say, slandered online, which I thought was a little sad, is that she just simply said, like, the tagline was, I wonder if I've experienced a pain that not even Jesus experienced. And, you know, that's kind of that's what the trades ended up using as the clip. And, you know, you could take that out of context. But her thought was, you know, something that she struggles with and grapples with her own faith is that she understands the magnitude of the sacrifice of Jesus, that great dark Friday, and all that it cost him and all the pain that it was. But she said, but he was keenly aware of the fact that he was going to raise again in 3 days. And so she wondered in her own pain that had lasted a couple months up until this point, like, is waiting and enduring and not knowing a human suffering that not even Jesus himself could empathize or sympathize with? And, you know, take that for what it is. It was just, it wasn't something meant to be overly analyzed. It was meant to be someone in faith and in crisis observing their pain and just communicating like true suffering. And so I thought that was interesting. Her takeaway could also be scrutinized, I suppose, but she took Saturday as the day where Christ was dead and had to wait and remain for the promises of his God as well. And so, you know, again, you could take nitpicky with theology. That's not really what we're here for. What we're here representing is this is someone, modern, prolific woman, who said, I am struggling with the will of God and seeing the will of God and understanding the will of God in my life and the days within it. I thought that it was moving and it was impactful in its own right. Someone else let me make sure we get this right. I think I did the wrong one. Pressed the wrong one. David, I ruined you, I think. There we are. John Milton. John Milton is someone in kind of will represent Christian historical figure, an individual in the 1700s, I believe, or 16 or 1700s, who was kind of, you know, after a big wave of reformers trying to get back to just like Christianity, he fought like a lot of in his writing, like the Church of England, and stood out and opposed them. But he was also someone who's just known as being like one of the great poets in English literature, which I am no poet nor son of a poet. So it's one of those art forms that's kind of lost on me. But I can appreciate the fact that he is someone who advocated for a true, sincere Christianity. It cost him a lot of friends. It cost him a lot of comforts. He was thrown into prison and endured a lot. And he tried to use his talents and his resources and his mind for the cause of Christ, no matter the cost. And yet, some of his most popular poetry comes to one specific conflict he ran into in his latter part of his life, was that he was losing his eyesight. And so some of his most popular poems, especially one we're going to note called When I Consider How My Light is Spent, he was kind of just grappling with like, man, like I've got a talent and I've got a skill set that I use to contribute to society, that I use for self-expression. I mean, he worked years for his mind and his trade and his craft. And he also is an individual who just used his strengths for God, to glorify God. And I think he kind of wondered, like, why is this theme that I'm good at, that I use for the glory of God, why is this being ripped from me? And this poem ends with this. The murmur soon replies, God doth not need either man's work or his own gifts. Who best bear his mild yoke, they serve him best. His state is keenly, thousands at his bidding speed, and post o'er land and ocean without rest. They also serve only who only stand and wait. If you're like me, I probably ruined the cadence there and I apologize, but like what it's getting across here is that even in the loss of who he was and what he contributed and what he felt he glorified God with, he still is beckoned to just wait for God and God's will in his life. We're going to look at one more figure, someone who's pretty popular in Christianity, I would say. Someone who kind of kick-started the movement of Christ would be John the Baptist. If you're familiar with John the Baptist, he's an individual who's a very bold character. He's kind of like considered the prophet of prophets. He's the one that all the other prophets, all the other spokesmen for God, like had been leading up towards. He's the cousin of Christ. He was there synonymous with Jesus, you know, coming into the world at the same time in ministry, at the same time. He was just a little before him every step of the way. And he's the one who kind of makes way for Jesus to come into this world and the kingdom to take root here. And even this man of bold, polarizing figure that he was, he still, it seemed to be grappled with some stuff in his life. What we're going to be doing is, you can turn over there if you'd like, but we're going to be looking at two passages today, Matthew 11 and then John 3. We will probably, I would recommend you go to John 3 first, but this excerpt is going to come from a time near the end of his life before he is unceremoniously killed for his confidence and his bold proclamation for God's will. This is kind of a last note we're kind of given on his life story. Matthew 11 verses 1 through 3 reads, "When Jesus had finished instructing his 12 disciples, he went on from there to teach and preach in their cities. Now when John heard in prison about the deeds of the Christ, he sent word by his disciples and said to him, 'Are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another?'" And it's kind of just almost a defeating tone he presents. It's, again, it kind of comes at a confusing way because John, again, was very synonymous with being bold, confident, and polarizing. And this individual seemed to have almost a defeated tone at the last end of his life, which is kind of sad. But and for that reason, I think there are people, I came across a few individuals who think that maybe what he was doing was just sending his disciples to Jesus, to the Christ, and saying, "Hey, like, you followed me all this time. Now look to him and see for yourselves that he is the one." And that might be true. Clearly, I'm taking an alternative reading on this, which is that it makes more sense in context that I think that this is a bit of a defeated tone he has. This is a real question, a real frustration, perhaps even a doubt, if you will, that he is grappling with Jesus and wondering, has he wasted his entire life for this? In chapter 10, Matthew chapter 10, Jesus just gets done taking his disciples close to him, sending them out and empowering them for the first time to go on out without him. And he gives them some tips on like how to survive, but also just to say, like, be strong. Like, you're going to suffer for my sake. So who are you going to fear? Are you going to fear the world around you and what they can do against you? Or are you going to fear the one who holds your soul, who can reward you beyond any reward this world can offer? And so it kind of makes sense for in context for these disciples to see that like following Jesus is an overwhelming, fearful, evolving space in life. Like it comes in different forms and in different fashions. And so whenever we come here to chapter 11, we see even one of the most bold proclaimers of Jesus is wondering, is it worth it? Is wondering like, is this actually the way forward or not? And have we invested our time and his entire life for something that's going to be worthwhile in the end? That's a fair question, because if nothing else, John is just looking and observing like, man, like, this isn't the way I would do Messiah. This isn't the kingship I would think. Like, you know, the Messiah figure was meant to come in their theory and in their conversation, you know, extract Rome from them, right? And be like, get out the hierarchy. But that didn't happen. It was meant to come and take out in unjust leaders. And yet, you know, Herod's still winning and he keeps getting away with his indecency. John's not like a physically minded person. He's not someone who's there for his best interest. But if nothing else, like John understood like the kingdom is coming, repent and transform your life and your morality into like better choices, if nothing else, because of how severe and important this is. And yet the world is still full of corruption around him. And he's sitting in a cell, we would assume for the most part, by himself, wondering and grappling with, was this worth it in the end? And I think all three of these figures we've talked about, we've noted at today, represent just a small sect of voices of people who wonder where God is how he's working, and what the will of God is in our life. And I think that they'll all kind of be our commonality. We're going to obviously stick with John the Baptist today, but they're going to kind of have a commonality for us today, is the evolving nature of our erasure of oneself. You know, the erasure being like, man, the disappearance of my preferences, of my comforts, of my prejudices, of what I thought life should look like, of my will in total, and just saying like that is completely dissipating for him. The erasure of oneself in this life when approaching the God of all life. And I wanted to highlight the idea of it being an evolving thing, because I really do think like, man, like, we will have to confront in so many different areas of our life the will of God, where there is going to be times where we are going to have to see and look closely to wonder, what is God doing and what is God asking of me? And this might be a crude attempt, and I'm sure it's imperfect, but I was trying to think of some important buckets that like represent like, okay, like what are times that are transitional that we are going to really have to confront what God wants for me, what God is asking for me, or what God is doing in our life? And again, this might be an imperfect exercise, but in this, I've come up with a few of them. These four buckets of conflict will be, first off, just giving up my will for his. It's like that initial, like, he's going to be Lord and master of my life. There's a time where all of us confront, like, am I choosing my way or am I choosing his way? And whenever we call Jesus Lord, we're saying, like, it's going to be his will and I'm going to choose that. But then from there, you think about, like, whenever the stakes actually happen, whenever, like, adjusting for actual stakes and lived-in experiences. And, like, that's when things get real. That's when, like, the growing process begins, whenever I actually have to tell myself no or push myself to be bold and confident for Christ. And, like, that's when it gets real. And that's another time where we really have to start confronting, like, is it my will or is it his will that's chief and keen of my life? That's something, you know, John did very well. Like, he was someone who, like, he understood the cost, man. He went out into the wilderness. He's someone who was willing to be, like, boldly proclaiming against false teachers. It probably cost him, you know, some relationship isolation. And he was willing to go to prison for his convictions and willing to stay in there. And it's just all these different things. Like, he understood the price. But I think we're kind of leaning in towards the second two, analyzing the cloudy nature of God's movement in our lives. And I have to say this, I think God's will is like, it's like the one faithful part of this life. Like, God's will is unchanging. God's will is unmoving. Like, God's will is faithful, and yet we live in a world that is so unfaithful. Even my own life and my own actions and my own relationship with God is unstable, and because of that, we just naturally live in a world where you can't fully anticipate what the will of God is and the way of God is and the movement of God in my life. And we're building up to number four here. This is where I invite you to turn over to John chapter 3. But this is something that, like, summarizes all of it. Like, truly beholding the will of God in my life and choosing to submit to it or not is inviting its significance for his glory. Inviting a lessening of myself for what he's doing in this world. And again, I think it's a very evolving nature. What we're going to do is we're going to go back to John 3. John 3 is going to represent this space for us, because I want to look at these two passages and gain some insight from John's specific story. And this is going to be before, it says, this is before he's in prison. So this is before he's gotten to that low point in Matthew 11, and I think it's referenced in Luke 7 as well. Like, this is before that time. But let's just see, like, his resolve. Like, that's what I'm calling this, is his resolution. Like, he has decided for himself, this is what I'm going to do. This is the temperament I am accepting for myself, and this is what I'm just choosing to live out in my life. So let's read John chapter 3, verse 25. What happens here is Jesus' disciples and John's disciples, two movements should be working together, are kind of butting heads a little bit. I think they're literally getting closer to each other geographically. And this is what happens. Now, a discussion arose between some of John's disciples and a Jew over purification. I'm sure that's worthy of its own, like, what was the heated exchange? There might be some insight on that, but actually the text kind of just stops discussing that for now. It goes into, like, how this is actually more of a, I don't know, maybe like a territorial thing? I don't know. Verse 26, and they came to John and said to him, Rabbi, he who was with you across the Jordan, to whom you bore witness, look, he is baptizing and all are going to him. This is John's answer. A person cannot receive even one thing unless it is given him from heaven. You yourselves bear me witness that I have said, I am not the Christ, but I have been sent before him. Again, just summarizing who he is and what his ministry is all about. Verse 29, the one who is the bride is the bridegroom. The friend of the bridegroom who stands and hears me rejoices greatly at the bridegroom's voice. Therefore, this joy of mine is now complete. I think that's a really fascinating, awesome place to just see what John has like resolved and adopted for himself. He's saying, I'm the best man. You know, another analogy would be, I'm the maid of honor. Like, I am the one who's here supporting the one who is the central figure. And I think that in that analogy, if nothing else, we kind of get emotionally what he's trying to communicate. Like, it's, I mean, if you've ever been in a wedding party, like every good moment is sort of a funeral in its own way. Like, it's like, man, this is an awesome, magnanimous moment that we're all in favor of. But like, if you're the best man or the maid of honor, you are saying goodbye to a dynamic you had with a loved one that's no longer. And you're doing it in their best interest. You're doing it as a supportive figure. You're doing it as someone who understands that this is the best route forward, but it still is a loss to something. And he still says, like, but I understand the point of it. I understand why I came here. It was never about me. It was about him. It was never about my gain, my longevity, my life. It was about preparing everything for him. And so he says, my joy has been made complete. My joy is finalized and it's matured to the point that I truly am not just like happy, but I have a substantial purpose and meaning and passion in my life by being the supporting one. And so we come to verse 30, well read by Mr. Levi. One of those verses I think we're going to read together, if I'm not mistaken, it should be the one on the board at the end, that is so simple and so essential to our faith that I think every single one of us either knows it or should memorize it because it's pretty straightforward. Verse 30, this is his summary. He must increase, but I must decrease. And it's so simple and so challenging to understand that this is something that John himself was resolved to stand for, accepted as his own, stood strongly for, and said, I'm not here for my glory, my success, my comforts, my preferences, or the way that I think the world should function. I am here to make his work. And through that, I receive joy, I receive passion, I receive sustainability and meaning in this life. And so it's an amazing section of scripture. And I don't think any of it's lost by the fact that, again, this acceptance, this resolution is an evolving theme because, like, man, like, life continues to throw us into hurdles and wondering what's the point of it all. Probably many of us have wondered a little resentfully, if not angrily, what is God doing and why would God allow? Why is God putting me in this position? Why is God putting my loved ones in this position? And you wonder, what is God doing within all of this? But for John, it still is, even for him, this is truly, I think, encapsulates who John was and what he stands for. Let's go back over to chapter 11, because I think in chapter 11 we do see, or sorry, Matthew chapter 11. I think in Matthew chapter 11, you kind of do see the cost. You do see like the flesh and bones nature of it. You do see that like John is kind of one of those like figures who feels more myth than human. He's like, again, like whenever he was born, it was through prophecy. Whenever he came about and he was in the womb, his baby literally reacted to Christ's womb. He's someone who was, again, like, wore crazy clothing, and my son is a brilliant young man, and I love that kid, but coming back from Bible class, there's like, you know, what did you learn about today? He's like, oh, not much sort of thing. That's fine. That's a two-year-old. I think that makes sense. And yet one of the things that he came back adamantly proud of knowing was like, that man ate bugs. Like, it's just one of those things, like those facts that you're just like, oh, like, this guy is just so, like, I don't know, polarizing and kind of mythical, and you don't see the human side of him so often because of just the nature of how he was documented, but this is one of those times you do see it where he does ask, like, what did I wait for, And am I waiting for something worthwhile? And are you the one or are you not? So going back to Matthew chapter 11. Sorry, I just realized I can't find it in my own Bible. Here we go. Matthew chapter 11. Let's start off reading verses 4 through 6. And Jesus answered them, the disciples who came to him, who asked him the question, "Go and tell John what you hear and see. The blind receive their sight, and the lame walk. Lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear. And the dead are raised up, and the poor have good news preached to them. And blessed is the one who is not offended by me." The word offense is a word, I'm probably going to butcher this, scandalizo, it basically comes from the word scandalized. Blessed is the one who's not offended by me to the point of sin, to the one who's polarized and pushed away from me, to the one who can't like gauge with me and follow me. And it makes sense because in, you know, Matthew 5, he says, "Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And it's like, that's a hard ask. That's a challenge. That's like an all in or not. And that is something that, again, is easy to say up front. I think I'm in this. I believe you. I'm putting my chips on you and I'm pledging to you. And then whenever it starts to actually live out, it becomes far more complicated, far more real, far more flesh and blood. So blessed are those who are not offended by Jesus. And what Jesus does is he recenters John on what he's doing. That's it. He just recenters him on the work that's actually happening in their world. Because for John's small little window of experience, it's a cell room, right? That's all he can see right there. And his anxiety and his frustration and his anger and in his sadness and in his fear, all he sees is his impending doom and the four walls around him. And that's all he can see right now. And he's wondering, where is the will of God and the action of God and the justice of God and the goodness of God? And Jesus recenters, like going back to Isaiah 35 and 61, and he says, like, "I'm actually here doing the very things I was foretold. I'm bringing healing. I'm helping the needy. I'm leading the way, just as I always had. You may not see it or experience it, and you may not have anticipated it in this way, but I'm still at work in ways that you can't see literally right now, in ways that maybe you don't fully understand, but I'm still here, and I'm still at work." Then let's go down to the following section, and here's kind of just a summary of the ministry of John, what he represents, how he's everything and nothing all mixed together. Let's go down to verse 7. As they went away, Jesus began to speak to the crowds concerning John. What did you go out into the wilderness to see? He's going to ask him a couple of rhetorical questions. Did you come to see a reed shaken by the winds? Do you see something that like could easily fall over? It's like, no. What then did you go out to see? A man dressed in soft clothing? That's not something anything John could be accused of. Behold, those who wear soft clothing are in kings' houses. What then did you go out to see? His final question, a prophet? Yes, and I tell you, and more than a prophet. He's much more than that. This is he of whom it is written, "Behold, I send my messenger before your face, who will prepare your way before you. Truly I say to you, among those born of woman, there has arisen no one greater than John the Baptist. Yet the one who is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he." He may have been the one who got it all going forward. He is like maybe the most significant mortal in all of time. And he's like, and yet he is deluded to this point where he will now be basically not talked of ever again in the text because his job has finalized. The erasure, if you will, has transpired. And then he goes on to acknowledge the obvious things in their surroundings. Verse 12, "From the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven has suffered violence, and the violent take it by force. For all the prophets and the law prophesied until John. And if you are willing to accept it, he is Elijah who was to come. He who has ears to hear, let him hear." So he commemorates his cousin, the ministry, this man, this prophet who's more than a prophet. And he also acknowledges that there is still violence, there's still suffering, there is still pain. And these truths can be synonymous at the same time. This is a quote that I found helpful from Craig Blomberg about this whole interaction. "The flow of thought may be summarized in this fashion. Despite John's questions, he should not be seen as a weak or vacillating. In fact, he is the greatest in a long succession of prophets. But great as he is, something greater is here, namely Jesus and the kingdom. but these are being attacked rather than universally welcomed. Still, such opposition should not deter would-be disciples, for God's predicted scenario is unfolding according to plan. And I ask the question, like, why is God's plan involve suffering? Why is God's plan involve pain? Why is God's plan involve a method that not even John, the man who was the spokesman for this kingdom, couldn't see? And the point is it's all about what Jesus is doing, what Jesus is working, even when we don't understand it. And that's maybe the point of this lesson, is not fully understanding and getting what's happening in the world around us and in our own lives, in our own pain and our own suffering, and still understanding that God works in ways that we fully don't understand. To conclude John's part of the story, which I think is a beautiful one, John Piper did a really good summary on John 3, and in this he used the bridegroom analogy. The bridegroom is getting all the attention. The cameras are flashing in all in that direction. The rice is all flying in that direction. The honeymoon is in that direction, and nobody glances back at the silence voice sitting on the church steps. The voice of the bridegroom, the voice of the shepherd, has replaced the voice crying in the wilderness. In a few months, the sword of Herod will absolutely silence John's voice. And John's response to this diminishing, to this decreasing, this great joy of mine is now complete. I think understanding and experiencing the will of God is an evolution of sorts. And we are at different times and different maturities and different life circumstances where we do have to confront it, and it feels like reconfronting it and resubmitting and reholding it to it day after day. Just like the wind itself doesn't fully make sense, we don't fully anticipate the days around us. And so in those times, in our cell blocks, in our times where it doesn't make sense, there is an invitation. All three of these voices that we talked about today, specifically John, kind of had some commonalities, and I kind of want to bring them together, but especially these two passages, that I think that if we find ourselves in that place where we just don't know the way forward and we're just not sure what to do, let's just look to John's example. When you are the voice in the wilderness crying out, remember these things. Remember your erasure. Remember the time where you decided for yourself, it is his way and not my way. And I think it is that cognitive reminder that we as followers of Christ need to recenter on day after day, to understand that we pledged him as Lord. We vowed that he was our king, that we decided he was our God. Our John 3:30, like we said, he will increase and we will decrease. And it is worthwhile to recenter on that and remember that within our lives when there are times where we are crying out in the wilderness. But secondly, remember your joy in him. Remember the fact that this is, and we understand and we affirmed that my way and my plans and my path forward will not bring my joy, my stability, or any meaningfulness to my life at the end of days. But his always will. His joy is our joy. And so remember, ultimately, your passion, your meaning, and your joy found fully in him, as John centers on. But another one is, remember his working. And that takes some creativity. We see this from this text. Like, John had to look beyond what he could understand or sense or see in this life. And he had to go beyond that. And he had to see that God's working has always been faithful, that God's goodness to him had always been true, and that even in times where he suffered pain, that God was still at work in the parameters of his life and the parameters of his experience. Remember his working, just as Jesus reminded John. And then kind of a this is the main one, isn't it? Remember him. Like, that's it. Remember the one who called you. Remember the one who provided for you. I'm going to kind of read for this part so I can make sure I get it right. Excuse me. Almost there. Here we go. Remember him as who has always been faithful. He has always been a faithful God, and he will not let your soul be abandoned in Sheol. Look to and fixate on the one who is indeed everything. Because that is the point. You on your own behalf and in your own capacity and your own ability would see corruption in your days. But he who has increased in all will not abide by that. He is faithful, he has overcome sin and death. He is everlasting and he is all. And I think that with that, there is one last observation that every single one of these voices have all had to accept. By looking to him and remembering him, you have to wait. That's the non-negotiable of this life. You have to wait. You have to wait for him. You have to wait for his will. You have to wait for his working and his revealing. And that's the human condition for those who call upon the name of the Lord. We must wait. That's a hard challenge. That's a difficult, human, universally shared experience that we all entangle with. But it's something that we come together to remember. And so what my concluding thoughts would be this is, if you are at a season of that where you are struggling with wondering what is next, what is going on, and what God's will is, please talk to someone. There would be an opportunity for you to come and pray with us, but our shepherds always meet in the back, and they love to meet with you in the library to pray with you. But also just talk to a friend and navigate these waters with fellow community. Also, you might be at a time where you are considering this decision for yourself. And this lesson today hasn't been the biggest selling point because it's talking about those who are in the middle of storms. But one thing that we all universally confess together, as is our theme from Travis this year, and we affirm together, is that through him is life, stability, and joy that we can never attain ourselves. And so if that's a decision you'd like to make and you'd like to confront that for yourself, we'd love to study with you. We'd love to see what it would take for you to call God your God. But what I'd like for us to do is we're going to stand here in a moment. I'm going to read one psalm. And as soon as we're done, I'm going to ask for us to be led into our final song. But remember, if there's anything, come forward whenever we sing. But let's stand up right now, and I'm going to read this psalm. Psalm 130, very popular psalm. Whoop, went back to him. Out of the depths I cry to you, O Lord. O Lord, hear my voice. Let your ears be attentive to the voice of my pleas for mercy. If you, O Lord, should mark iniquities, O Lord, who could stand? But with you there is forgiveness. That you may be feared, I wait for the Lord. My soul waits, and in his word I hope. My soul waits for the Lord more than watchmen for the morning, more than watchmen for the morning. O Israel, hope in the Lord, for with the Lord there's steadfast love, and with him there's plentiful redemption, and he will redeem Israel from all his iniquities. Let's sing together.